Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 29th. Today's session is The Purpose and Paradoxes of the Vocation of Parenting, presented by Marcia Bungie. The number of the tape is BUM2002-01. Let's listen in.
Let me just introduce myself briefly. I'm Marcia Bungie. I teach at Valparaiso University in the Honors College, a wonderful place to teach where we have very small classes and work with great books with just the very wonderful students. So that's where I teach. And my lecture series this week is on the vocation of parenting. The sessions are addressed to those, whether or not you have children, but to people who care about children, believe parenting is a significant moral and spiritual endeavor, and really want to enrich their understanding of the sacred task and how to carry it out in contemporary society with some of the struggles that we all share, I think, when we think about children today. So the sessions are meant not only for parents, but also for grandparents, aunts, uncles, and spiritual leaders, really for anybody who cares about children, who wants to reflect more deeply about them and about child-parent relationships, and who want to maybe discover ways of being better parents or more intentionally supporting parents in your area. My own interest in the vocation of parenting comes from having two children. We have a 9-year-old, and we just adopted a little girl, 1.5. And I also am very interested in issues of formation because I teach at a college, a church-related college, and we try to address the whole person, so we're always asking questions about what shapes these young people. And so I hear a lot about, from students, some of their struggles, from stories about their family background, so that also sparked my interest in issues of parenting. And then I'm concerned, as maybe many of you are too, about children today in our country and around the world, many of whom do face tremendous struggles, such as poverty or lack of an adequate education, depression, teenage suicide, or pregnancy and neglect. So I got more and more interested in this as we had our own children in the situation of children in our country and around the world too. Last year, I put together a book with a number of wonderful contributors on the child and Christian thought, and it looks at theological perspectives on children. How have we thought about children in the Christian tradition? There's some people who've said we really just look at them as sinful and you're supposed to beat them to hell, and that's about all they have to say about Christians have said about children. But we found just a wealth of attitudes, treatments of children as we look back in the whole history. So we finished this project, and now I'm wanting to work on this more thematic book. This is a very kind of historical, dense book, but was just such a mine of information about what we have thought in the Christian tradition about parents, about children, about the responsibilities of the state, the responsibilities of the church to children. So that was a lot of fun. So I'm trying to work on this more thematic book on parenting now. So the book I'm working on really has kind of was sparked by three convictions that, first of all, parenting is one of the most important moral and spiritual tasks that we can undertake. And it's a task that shapes not only the lives of children, but also the lives of parents. Second, although we recognize the importance of parenting, I don't think it's receiving the attention or respect that it deserves either in the culture or in our religious communities. And for many reasons, I think the importance of parents has been neglected and even undermined in our culture and sometimes in the church. I'm going to say more about that Thursday. So I think many parents are not finding the kind of spiritual resources or just practical support they need to carry out their task with integrity. And third, I think our religious tradition does contain wisdom. There are some sad chapters in the history of Christianity about how we've treated children, how we've thought about children. But the tradition also contains some wisdom for helping all of us better articulate the depth, the importance of parenting, and to provide a more meaningful vision of parenting for today that could help parents as they struggle to nurture the moral and spiritual lives of their children. So this week, the purpose of my sessions is to share some of my theoretical and practical ideas about parenting that I've taken from the tradition and mined quite a bit from that book, and to generate a rich discussion among us about parenting today. And so through the sessions, I hope we will be reflecting on the importance of parenting and suggesting some practical guidelines too, and practical suggestions for nurturing the moral and spiritual lives of children. So whether or not you have children of your own, I hope our discussions can encourage all of us to do more to support parents and children. Yeah.
Can I interrupt you just a moment?
Yeah.
The cheer of the Christian was so inviting, and I want to bring it back.
Great. Now, I bet everybody, I just brought 20 copies, so maybe you could share if you have one of those little blue handouts. I have plenty of a couple other handouts I can give you if you're interested in some more resources. I have a bunch of resources on a vocation itself, and also on literature about children today that I'll pass out at the end. Well, today, the theme of the session is the purpose and paradoxes of parenting. Everybody got some place they can, if you don't have to, it's not really necessary to have that outline, but it helps a little bit to follow along with what I'm doing today. So I want to focus today on the purpose and paradoxes of parenting. And I'll speak for about 30 minutes, something like that, and then we'll have some time for discussion, because I would like to hear very much your ideas and thoughts and suggestions and concerns about children and about parenting. Well, I think everybody recognizes that parenting is a large responsibility and a very complex task. It involves financial responsibilities, emotional intimacy, physical closeness, fun, love and affection, character development, and spiritual guidance. It's also an especially difficult task because most parents are trying to balance their responsibilities as parents and their responsibilities to their own children with a number of other commitments and obligations, maybe to their extended family, maybe to their profession, maybe to the wider community. So given all the varied dimensions and demands of parenting, how might we think about its central purpose? Are there ways that we could think about parenting that can help us set some priorities and help us navigate our way through our multiple obligations and commitments at home, at work, and in civil society? Well, I want to begin to reflect on these kinds of questions today by talking a little bit about the concept of vocation in general and discussing why it's important, I think, to emphasize that parenting is a vocation and parenting is a sacred task too. So just now a little bit about the general concept of vocation. The Christian concept of vocation is a complex notion and has a very long and varied tradition in Christianity. It's a concept that speaks very meaningfully about our deepest concerns, about what we want to do with our lives and who we are, how we want to live. Now, unfortunately, I think sometimes in our contemporary culture we use vocation in a too narrow of a way, and I think there's three ways that we often misunderstand or misuse vocation. First of all, vocation is sometimes equated with our occupation or with paid work. This is particularly true among Protestants, who often speak of vocation as their paid work, their occupation. Where I work at Valparaiso, for example, when we talk about professors, we say, what is their vocation? It's teaching. And then we narrow it to only that as their vocation. Or second, vocation is often understood as sort of something like finding one's inner joy or finding self-fulfillment. It's understood as what one does, whether paid or not, to find sort of fulfillment and wholeness in life. And this view of vocation is very common among some of my students who think about finding vocation in terms of finding personal happiness, just personal happiness. And third, vocation is sometimes understood as entering the priesthood or becoming a monk or nun. And this is particularly true among Catholics, even though many Catholic theologians are trying to change this conception. I worked on a very big grant on vocation for our university. A $2 million grant. We got this grant. We were so happy. And a lot of Catholic institutions got this too. And they could not name their program vocation because everybody thought it meant, oh, this is the program for kids who want to become priests and nuns and monks. So they had to call it something like Faith and Learning Center or something else. So I had a lot of fun talking to my Catholic colleagues about that what they were doing with their grant. Well, within the wisdom of Christian tradition, vocation is a rich concept That certainly means more than paid work, more than self-fulfillment, more than becoming a priest, monk, or nun. That word vocation comes from the Latin vocatio, which means calling. And although it is a complex concept with varied meanings, I think at the very heart of this concept is the notion that we are called to use our gifts and talents to love and serve others, to contribute to the common good, and in this way we participate in God's care and redemption of the world. So vocation is really primarily about serving others and participating in God's care and love for the world and God's plan for serving neighbors in need. So it's not just our paid work, because we carry out our vocation and serve others not only in our formal jobs, but also in the home and in our responsibilities as citizens or neighbors. Vocation is not just self-fulfilling work, but rather work that serves others and contributes to the common good. And vocation is not just restricted to so-called religious professions, but is broad enough to include all kinds of work and activities, paid or unpaid, that serve others and strive for justice. Now, one of the theologians who reflected so deeply on vocation and was very influential in many traditions, not just in the Lutheran tradition, was Martin Luther. I want to say just a couple words about how he sharpened this notion of vocation. He enlarged the view of vocation by emphasizing that in addition to this kind of general calling Christians have to love and serve others and contribute to the common good, each person is also called to specific vocations, to specific, he called them stations, or places of responsibility in which we serve the well-being of others. That can be at home, or could be at work, or could be in civic life. So he believed all believers are supposed to use their gifts and talents to love and serve others. And he believed that although one is saved or justified by faith alone, faith frees and empowers one to go out and use one's gifts to love and serve others. So in this sense, he thought that all Christians share a kind of common, large sense of vocation, but maybe a big V, that we all have this general calling to go out and use our gifts and love and serve others. But he also claimed that in addition to this larger common Christian calling, people also honorably carry this general Christian calling out in a wide variety of very specific vocations or very specific stations or places of responsibility in which they serve the well-being of others, again at home, in your professional life, or in civic life. He recognized that service to others is lived out in a number of ways. And he also recognized, and I think this is really important for people today, that we serve others in kind of multiple ways. We almost have sort of multiple specific vocations. The local doctor, for example, certainly serves others, has a specific vocation there, responsibilities as a doctor, but he also might be a spouse, or he or she might be a spouse, or be a parent and then has specific responsibilities as a parent. So he thought about people, at that time he was thinking mainly of men who had sort of multiple sort of vocations, because the female was to be in the home and that was the one kind of specific vocation that she had as the mother or spouse or daughter of some of her parents. But he did have this notion that we kind of have to balance some of these multiple responsibilities and obligations. All of these responsibilities are part of a person's vocation. So through this view of vocation that he had, he rejected a very common notion at the time that people who enter the priesthood or become monks and nuns are more pleasing to God than people who live out their lives in the so-called affairs of the world. So for Luther, being a baker, a teacher, a politician, spouse, parent, these all had the same kind of integrity as being a priest or a monk or nun. For Luther, the many duties and responsibilities we carry out in our personal, professional, and civic lives are all vehicles of God's continuing care and redemption for the world. So it was really neat the way he kind of enlarged the notion of vocation and made it a little more specific by honoring activities and responsibilities outside the priesthood, by honoring not only paid work, but our duties at home, our duties in the community, and by honoring our role as citizens and this duty we have to contribute to the common good. So Luther's perspective on vocation challenges the tendency I think we have in our own culture of ranking certain vocations as greater or less than. Among my students, for example, it's really neat if you're an engineer or you're going on into medicine, but it's not so neat if you're going to be a teacher or a maybe even a pastor, that sort of ranked a little bit lower. Or I think the struggle we have among people when you talk about your work in the home or your work outside the home. So this kind of shatters that ranking mentality, and we all see that everybody's sort of contributing in their own way with their unique gifts and talents in these specific kinds of places in life. Now, how do we discern those particular vocations? And there, the tradition is so interesting because it happens a number of ways. It isn't always through some grand vision or some lightning bolt. That a lot of times it comes through prayer or meditation, but it also comes a lot of times just through your relationships to other people, by serving other people. You kind of sort of see, where are my gifts? What am I doing? Oh, look how I'm helping those in need. It comes out that way. Or Luther had this idea too. It sometimes just comes out in the very act of carrying out the responsibilities you already have. For example, he said, everybody has a vocation, even a little kid, because they're a daughter or a son, and they have certain responsibilities as a daughter or son. It's given to them. They didn't get some divine calling, that you are, some lightning bolt, you are the daughter. But they already were given a certain place of responsibility, and they have to carry those things out, too. So it's kind of interesting. We talk about how you've discerned your vocation, this more specific sense of vocation, because it's very interesting how varied that is in the tradition.
You don't have to go on a 36-day Ignatian retreat.
Right. Have some of you read, by the way, this novel Jaber Crow by Wendell Berry? Has anyone? It's a wonderful novel, and it has a lot of environmental themes. Wendell Berry writes so much on environmental responsibility, but it has a lot about vocation. And this one guy, he's an orphan in this Christian orphanage, and if an orphan becomes a pastor, it's like, oh, we made it, we did a great job here at the institution. So they're always trying to encourage the kids, are you thinking of being a pastor? And so he goes out one night, he thinks he heard a call in the night, this mysterious call. And there's this wonderful little line in there. He says, well, I don't know if I really heard the call, but I thought I better follow the call just in case I hadn't heard it clearly. And he doesn't become a pastor. He becomes a barber. But he does a wonderful job of just seeing how does he serve others as this barber, this kind of humble profession, cutting people's hair. It's kind of vulnerable, touching the body. I mean, it's a very wonderful novel if you get a chance. It's one of the best novels I've read the last couple of years, just Jaber Crow. Well, let's talk about now, you can see how rich a concept vocation that is, because it invites us to ask so many questions and helps us, if we're thinking about what's our meaning and purpose in life, it helps us ask questions about what are our gifts and talents, what are the needs of the neighbor, what is God calling me to do, do my goals and fit with my values and beliefs. If I get married, if I have kids, how am I going to balance all my responsibilities as a parent and as a perhaps a professional or as a citizen? So I think it's a very rich concept for today, and especially so because it emphasizes service, and I think that's very nice in this time where we often emphasize individualism, and in our kind of time of bowling alone, maybe you've read that book by Putnam, who talks about kind of how we've lost kind of sense of civic responsibility. And this notion of vocation kind of lifts that up very nicely. Well, since vocation is often equated with careers or self-fulfillment or priesthood, we don't always think of parenting as a vocation or sacred task. But I think by thinking about it as a vocation, I think this concept of vocation really helps us think about the importance of parenting and in what way it is a sacred task. So let me just now turn to the second part about the purpose of parenting. Because given the central calling of vocation given to all Christians, The main purpose in the Christian tradition, when they're talking about parenting, the main purpose of parenting, a lot of traditions would say, is that you've got to help children live out their calling, And that is, the main purpose of parenting from a Christian perspective is to raise children in the love and service of God and to help them use their gifts and talents to love and serve the neighbor and to contribute to the common good. That's your kind of main concern as a parent. Parents are to help children grow in faith and love and serve the neighbor, especially those in need. Now, Christian traditions will talk about this purpose in a little varied kind of language. Some speak about the role of parents as helping children become disciples or children of God, walking in the footsteps of Jesus. That's kind of your main task, to help your children do that. Others will say the primary obligation of parents is to teach children godliness. And there's a section in the Bible that talks about godliness. And so they'll say that's the role of parents. Or pietists and others have spoken about the central task of parenting to be fostering true faith or fostering piety. And in all these cases, the central task isn't merely to foster certain feelings or attitudes in children about God or certain ideas about God. No, discipleship, piety, godliness, becoming a child of God, or true faith all emphasize that one is to have a living, active faith that expresses itself in service to the others, to the other, to the neighbor. So it's always very outward kind of sense of a very active, living faith that lives out its faith in concrete deeds of service to others. Now, this way of speaking about the central purpose of parenting is related to, yet distinct from, some of the common ways we talk about a larger goals of parenting. We certainly all would say, oh, parents must love and nurture their children. We all say that. But we sometimes also talk about larger goals. For example, we'll say sometimes that a good parent should provide their child with a good education, get them to college so that they have a meaningful job, or at least so that they're not in jail, and you can, you know, say, my kid's self-sufficient, I'm not paying for the kid's, you know, groceries. So, or we focus less on the future work of our children and say, we just want our children to be happy. We want to feel good about themselves. We want to have self-esteem. Or we might say that parents should raise their children to become productive citizens, to become very good citizens in society. Now, the Christian notion of vocation takes up some of these themes, but it kind of shifts the meaning of that because it claims that when one's life is centered on God and when one has a sense of one's larger calling to love and serve the neighbor, then you will find deep happiness, but it will be kind of a deep happiness found by loving and serving others. And education will be important, but it's not just so that you feel good about yourself or get a good job, but it's a way to use your gifts and sharpen your skills to love and serve others. Or you would say your work is fulfilling. We would say we want children to find fulfilling work in this notion of vocation, but a kind of maybe a deeper sense of fulfillment by having not only a kind of self-satisfaction, but the satisfaction of really loving and serving others. And having the sense that your work is part of a larger purpose of God's care and redemption of the world. So anyway, it takes up some of those themes, but it centers them more on the service to others and using these gifts and talents we have to love and serve others. Now, there's a lot of wonderful language used in the tradition to talk about how sacred this task of parenting is. And I love this kind of language because I think we don't talk enough about how spiritual, what a spiritual discipline it is to be a parent. So I have just a couple examples here, like this guy John Chrysostom. He was lived in the 4th century, and he wrote a lot about the family and about children. And he's very important still to Eastern Orthodox communities of faith today. And he said, for example, that parenting is a tremendously sacred task. And he mentioned among the world's greatest evils are neglect of children. And a great injustice is of the neglect of children. And he uses language like this. He talks about parents as artists who paint pictures or build statues with great precision, because they're kind of helping to restore the image of God in their children. So they're kind of taking their child, and they can't form everything about a child, but they're kind of sharpening this image of God in their children. Or he uses this notion that the family is a little church or a sacred community. And this notion that a family is a little church underscores the notion that parents are the ones who have the primary responsibility for nurturing the moral and spiritual lives of their children. In addition, he was very concerned, this Christensen, about greed and affluence in his society. He worked with a lot of very rich people in his area, and he was very concerned about this. And he thought by using that metaphor of the little church, it was very powerful because it helped emphasize that the family doesn't just look out for itself, but it's a little church that also reaches out and helps the needs of others. So in that sense, it's a very positive image that kind of enlarges your sense of the family just taking care of its own, but reaching out to others. Or Luther, the 16th century reformer, he reflected extensively about the task of parents. And he underscored the importance of parenting by saying that parents are apostles, priests, and bishops to their children. Here's one quote. He says, "Most certainly, father and mother are apostles, bishops, priests to their children, for it is they who make them acquainted with the gospel. In short, there is no greater or nobler authority on earth than that of parents over their children, for this authority is both spiritual and temporal. It's very practical, it's down to earth, but it's also very much related to the very deep shaping of one's moral, spiritual development." Although Luther knows that parenting can be a difficult task and is often considered insignificant and even a distasteful job, he believes parenting is serious and a divine calling that is adorned, here's another quote from him, "with divine approval as with the costliest jewels and gold." Here's one very famous quote where he says, "Now you tell me, when a father goes ahead and washes diapers or performs some menial task for his child, and someone ridicules him as a fool, even though the father is acting in the spirit just described in Christian faith, my dear fellow, you tell me which of the two is most keenly ridiculing the other. God, with all his angels and creatures, is smiling, not because the father is washing diapers, but because he's doing so in Christian faith." So he has some really great lines about how just, you know, man, you got to get in there and, you know, slobber and mess all over the place. But it's a divine calling. And one last person I'd like to mention is this Horace Bushnell. He was a Congregationalist in the 19th century, wrote a beautiful little book about nurturing children. And he also talks about the family as a little church. Although he saw the important role of the church in helping develop faith in children, he said that the primary agent of grace is the family and not the church. He has this wonderful line where he says, "Religion never thoroughly penetrates life until it becomes domestic." So it never thoroughly penetrates life until it becomes domestic. He said, if you take them to Sunday school and you drop them off, but it never penetrates and you never have the rituals at home, it doesn't really take. It's through the actions, the everydayness. So he gave a lot of suggestions about not just reading the Bible and teaching children aspects of the faith, but other practices and routines that he thought really helped nurture faith, and certainly the examples of parents themselves. So he emphasized the heroic importance of small things and everyday things. He has this wonderful line where he says, "It requires less piety to be a martyr for Christ than it does to maintain a perfect and guileless integrity in the common transactions of life." Just that everyday common life is more difficult. He encourages parents to interweave lessons about faith with fun and play and a fun activity. So it's a really kind of interesting book he wrote then. Well, I think you might see then some of the importance of viewing parenting as a vocation, as a sacred task. I mentioned just a few here. I think it elevates the seriousness of parenting at a time when professional careers often take priority over all other commitments. It helps to articulate that depth of parenting and the kind of really powerful experience it is. The concept of vocation also invites parents and those who care about children to reflect on a whole range of moral, spiritual, and practical questions, because it invites them to talk about very large life goals and life commitments, but also to talk very specifically about your unique gifts and talents. Since the concept of vocation honors work inside and outside the home, and since it honors paid work, as well as volunteer work and domestic work, I think it helps parents reflect on their multiple responsibilities as parents, perhaps spouses, sons and daughters, citizens, and neighbors. This is especially important, I think, today when it is so difficult to try to manage and balance all the responsibilities and obligations we have at home, at work, and in civic life. The concept of vocation also provides the language for parents to speak about life commitments and goals with their children that go beyond that kind of common language and the typical set of questions we have about careers or finances, to include questions about how are you going to use your gifts and talents, what kinds of needs do you see in our community, how do you think you can best contribute. And I think although we sometimes assume young people are kind of cynical, they are really yearning for ways to make a difference. And I think I see that so powerfully in my college students, who are really yearning for lives that matter. And I think vocation provides a way for parents to kind of start talking about that. Vocation provides a way of speaking not only about duties and obligations of parents, but also those of children, starting as sons and daughters, and then up even through students. We've started talking at our university about what does it mean that you are in this place, and what are your responsibilities as a student in college? You have certain responsibilities here, and what are those? We've started talking even about the vocation of a student, a college student. What is that involved? And that's been very helpful in our setting. And finally, the concept of vocation also helps to ward off cynicism and pessimism among parents and children, because it's grounded in this trust that there is a God who sustains the world, who loves and forgives us, even when we fall short, and who empowers us to use our gifts and talents to love and serve those in our midst. So I think this notion of a theological understanding of parenting as a vocation, seeing it as a sacred task, really helps us address so many different kinds of questions. The depth of experience we have as parents, or it helps us talk about what is parental love, what are responsibilities and duties to children, what can I learn from my child about faith and service to others, what particular beliefs are shaping my attitudes and my maybe discipline of my child, what Christian virtues most inform my treatment of children, and what are my obligations not only to my own children, but to children in the community. So these are some of the questions I want to explore further in the week. I wanted to just close briefly before we open the discussion with just a couple words about the paradoxes of parenting, because there's many paradoxes contained in this notion that parenting is a vocation and a sacred task. And I mentioned just three of them here. First of all, many parents have the experience that by trying to raise children to love and serve God and the neighbor, they paradoxically deepen their own faith and their own desire to love and serve the neighbor. So teaching children godliness is often a process of one's own formation, one's own sort of faith formation. There's a theologian, Christine Gudorf, has claimed that the successful development and growth of children depends very much on the growth and maturation of the parents, and that it is a maturation process, becoming a parent. Once parents have children, parents must re-examine their own childhood, their family of origin. They have to reevaluate their priorities. They have to think about their hopes and desires for the future. And I think many of you know, or maybe this happened in your own life, that parenting was kind of a turnaround for a lot of people. They kind of went a little different direction because of what was going on as they were parents. This Robert Coles, the Harvard psychologist who's written so much on the spiritual lives of children, the moral lives of children, he recognized this paradox when he says, we always learn from children, even when we try to teach them. And he believes that we too often, matters of character or virtues development values clarification, and here we could add spiritual development. Get presented sort of as a one-way street. We're going to do this to kids and, you know, get this job done with kids. But in contrast, he has found that parents and children continually learn from one another and are responding to one another. He has many interviews with children about moral, political, and spiritual questions are powerful testimonies to this claim that children both learn from adults but also shape adults in profound ways. A second paradox is that parents need to hold together the paradoxical notion that their task is serious and urgent, and yet that faith ultimately comes from God's activity and God's grace. So they have to strive to be very good parents and believe they're making a difference, yet recognize that good parenting does not always have predictable, guaranteeable results. This guy Chrysostom, he's so funny. He really thought if you are a good parent and you do everything, you can guarantee they're going to be great kids. Now, most theologians didn't go along with him, you know, but he even said that the salvation of parents and children are so intertwined and that parental responsibility is so great that the salvation of parents is dependent on the virtue of their children. But most, so watch out for that. He had no children. He was a monk. So that's why most theologians say, hey, the Holy Spirit's working the lives of children ways we don't know, and you know, the quality of their family life, congregational background, or surrounding culture also, you know, you can't guarantee the results because of those things. And furthermore, most theologians say that parents can't create faith or character in their children, that God certainly and the Holy Spirit, the Word, play a role in that, but that children also make choices. They're also influenced by cultural forces and by their peers, and that also shape their lives. So it's a little more complex than that. But nevertheless, these theologians have held up that parents can nurture their children in primary and significant ways by providing a space for the Holy Spirit to work, to try to give them the best kind of conditions possible as a parent, and that's your responsibility. And Martin Luther, for example, and other reformers who started a lot of religious education programs in the home, the catechism, you know, to be really done in the home or at church, held on to this paradoxical notion that although faith is a gift and ultimately comes through God's grace, that nurturing children is a very urgent and serious task, and that faith largely results from the diligent work of parents, adults, in the lives of children. So this paradox of parenting is reflected in that saying, pray as if everything depends on God and work as if everything depends on you. That's kind of how they looked at it. And one final paradox is that parents must be confident and yet at the same time remain humble and open to outside wisdom about parenting and to outside support. They need to go about their task of parenting boldly, yet recognize the limits of maybe some of their own thoughts and actions in regards to parenting, and remain open to learning more about parenting. They need to be open to refining their approach to parenting, and even at times being corrected about some aspects of what they're doing with their children. As they go about their daily tasks, we need to remain open to wisdom about parenting, perhaps from studies in a range of fields like psychology, sociology, theology, from friends and neighbors, and from children themselves. They also need to accept they're finite human beings who maybe need the support and do need, not just maybe, but do need the support of other people, of friends, of family, and the church. And I think this paradox there is very much related to this paradox you find throughout the Christian tradition of you need to be confident about your faith, but yet recognize the limits of your knowledge of God, that there's always kind of an openness to learning more about who God is and what our task is. I love this theologian, Michael Welker, a German theologian. He talks about faith as kind of the sense of a witness in a court case. A witness knows something and can say with confidence something, but doesn't know everything. And so you have to kind of remain open to what you don't know. And I think that's also true with parenting. Well, given the very general purpose of parenting as helping children live out the Christian calling of love and service, how do we carry out the purpose of parenting? What are the specific responsibilities and duties? What do we think about as kind of most important things we should be doing? Because just like every other job in life, whether we're talking about a doctor, teacher, lawyer, or as our duties as a husband, wife, daughter, son, we do have certain responsibilities and tasks. And so later this week, I want to be talking about some of those more specifically, some of the challenges facing parents and children today more specifically, and about maybe what the church can do to better help support parents. So we have time for discussion now, and I thought, because most people don't come to all things, you know, that you could just, we could open up a very general discussion about parenting. You could talk about what we mentioned today, the purpose and paradoxes. But if you want to talk about, oh, kind of attitudes to children, that's what I'm going to talk about tomorrow, or about certain responsibilities, attitudes, practice, what's worked in your life, what are some special practices or approaches that have been very helpful in your own background or as you work with children, whether your own or someone else's, or some specific challenges facing parents and children, and what the church could do to better support parents and children. So those are the kind of questions I'm really interested to hear, and some suggestions from you too. I have, just before we open this up, I want to say that I have you know, plenty of these. This is the selected resources on parenting and nurturing the moral and spiritual lives of children, a kind of bibliography that if people want to pick that up, you can pick that up later. And then I have this other green one. It's a select bibliography on vocation. Just a lot of text. I pulled out some text from Luther, but then a bunch of, and some secondary things on Luther, but then I have quite a few other additional texts just on vocation, if you're interested in reflecting more on that. So I'll put those out there, too, if you like those. Okay, well, so what are your own concerns, comments, questions? Yeah?
I would just like to say thank you for reminding us that parenting is a sacred task. Because I think one of the challenges that I face is remembering that it is very sacred, and we get so many messages from society that it's not that important, and other things should take priority. So I'm very grateful to you for doing that.
Encourage you to keep.
Yeah, good.
This message.
Yeah, there's a. I think it's in the bookstore. This one, The War Against Parents. Mm-hmm. This is a kind of interesting book that talks about so many messages are undermining the importance of parenting. This, the individualism and culture, but also other things like demeaning images of parents on television shows, and if you do look at it, it's like, whoa, they're always incompetent, and in movies too, you know. There's not too many, you know, powerful images, and I found too that, you know, a lot of very fundamentalist churches have a lot of literature about parenting, but for me it's too narrow. But then you get more sort of New Age spiritual books on parenting that I think are helpful in some ways, but they don't have any Christian category. This is maybe too broad. So that's kind of what I see a need for, too. Yeah.
Well, we've gone on television, we've gone from a 1950s, you know, Leave It to Beaverville parents who, and Ozzie and Harriet and all these other people who seem to know everything.
Yeah.
Father knows best, right?
Yeah.
All that stuff. And we know that's not true. To parents who were dupuses, basically.
Yes.
There's rarely anybody in between who says, well, you know, this was my experience. Maybe it'll be yours, but, you know, here's some guidelines and let's talk about it.
Yeah, yeah. That's interesting. There's this woman, too, this Piper, who wrote that book, Reviving Ophelia. She's written another book now on families, and how too in you know, the media, like you were mentioning too, and then even in psychology too, there's so much of, oh, your family is just not even worth it. You know, it's kind of like, get rid of it. But yet the family, yeah, it's kind of got a lot of messiness, you know, there's problems there, but there's a value to this family.
Well, there's nothing to replace it. I mean, psychology,
yeah.
and maybe you come to declare it. Conclusion, your parents were no good, if they were meth addicts or something, you
yeah.
probably got something going in that direction. But it's like getting rid of the clearing out the house with all the devils in it and everything,
mm-hmm.
or the exorcism. And but if you don't replace it with something, then back comes seven devils and
yeah.
back in the
yeah. Right. She talked about how you know, in some cases we need to create a family with people, not necessarily relatives, but that sometimes even with the broken, family does kind of help out sometimes people, you know, even if it's a pretty, that's a very good point. Mm-hmm.
Yes, you threw out so many ideas and so you covered a lot of territory in terms of ideas, but one day it occurred to me that parenting is such a tremendous responsibility as a parent of four boys, and everything that we do and say and think and even our the way we move and the expressions that we express with our bodies, our body language is so important.
Isn't it?
For in raising these children.
Yeah.
They're all different.
Yeah.
All boys.
Like you say, it's so many, it's so multi-dimensional, isn't it? You know, like you say, that it's doing, saying, the thinking, the values, and the gestures even. With this little girl we just adopted, she's been in an orphanage, you know, 17 months, and now we've had her 2 months, and it's amazing what you do. Like, my husband was kind of going like this, well, she was going to go like that. You know, it's really so, it was just, the imitation is tremendous. But that's a very good point about the vast, just all the levels of parenting.
Yes, and there were a lot of ideas that my own parents used. Of course, that was way back, and I'm going to date myself now, but back in the 30s and 40s, when they were raising me, there were a lot of ideas that they used that I found didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
In the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
When I raised my boys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe we could talk too about real practical things that are working, that you found, you know, among, in your own family or among friends, that you found that is really, has been very helpful.
Well, I think that keeping the openness and the communication going,
mm-hmm.
because we, one boy in particular, we used to have discussions, and we used to even have flip board discussions on certain things, issues that came up, and he would go talk it over with his friend's father, and come back and then we discuss it some more.
That's great.
Flip charts in the living room.
We did that.
That's good. You know, do you know Bob Benny? I know he won't mind me telling you, but he's an ethicist teacher at Norwalk College. He wrote a nice little piece in the Crescent little journal about what he wished he had done. And the one thing he wished he had done with his children was talk more to them, have more conversations, because he thought by being an example, they would just pick it up by osmosis, mm-hmm. and they didn't. And he said, really, I think about it now, we didn't talk about any of these things together. And then, you know, when Littleton came up, there were so many young people on the radio talking about how they never talk with their parents. You know, and that there's one study that 75% of young people, teenagers, want to talk more with their parents. But you think about people's schedules, and if you believe the statistics, people don't eat together anymore, dinner. I mean, how are you talking?
Yeah, it can be true.
And now the car has the video? I mean, whoa. At one place, I remember asking my dad and mom the most crucial questions. They could not get out of the car.
Similar to that, there are studies that are just breathtaking in terms of the number of minutes that teenagers don't or speak to adults. And in fact, it's very small.
Mm-hmm.
Many children do not have interactions with, mm-hmm. beyond parents, other adults. And so, you know, as a parent of two boys, I think about forums, places, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, where can those moments be? Of course, there's school, but that's a different kind of dynamic than it is, you know, in a situation where they are talking with somebody at a coffee hour at church.
Right.
That's an unusual circumstance.
Mm-hmm. I think it's important to what are occasions we create for making sure people, young people are trying to look at those. We have an insidious tradition now among people my age who have kids. Like when you have a dinner party, you have a dinner party and you have a nice dinner party for the parents. Yeah. And then they put the kids with the video and the, you know, sandwiches in the basement. And I remember I learned so much just having to sit in those boring dinners with the adults. And, but you picked up what's, why are they so worried about that? You know, you picked up a lot, so that's a very good point. Yeah, what were you going to say?
Well, and kind of hooking into part of what Dan said was also that I find it so complex and so many things and this, you know, having so many multiple roles simultaneously that going back to the it takes a village to raise a child, that I would like to see more tools for all of us to incorporate other people into the raising of both, you know, so that we do it, mentor other children, you know, and not just focus on our own, but also how do we how do we enable situations that allow, you know, us as groups of people to provide support and the individual things that we have to offer.
I think so much of my role is being a teacher, and a teacher who has two, but very different kids, and I can't treat them the same. I can't, you know, one of them will talk quite easily, and the other one, we have to stand on our head, and I don't know what. I don't know how to get him to talk. And, you know, we provide this time, we're all together, we're sitting, but I can't make him talk. And so, you know, this task as a teacher, okay, how do I get to this kid, and how do I, you know, try to provide those opportunities in those places?
Especially when your kids are different, like you're saying.
Sometimes, I don't know if it's always true, but sometimes boys and girls have different abilities to talk, and I've heard and read that boys will talk when they're doing an activity, like shooting baskets or something like that. Those activities, they're more alongside, but not just sitting down to talk face-to-face, but more in the context of activity.
And maybe I need to remember that, is that I'm the only female in my family, so it's the dog, so I, you know.
Your family's just like ours. We have a cool dog, too.
This guy, Michael Leroy, who writes The Wonder Boys, kind of an interesting book. Some of us, you wonder, but
I think
it's where
I got that from.
Yeah, that kind of activity. Yeah, you were just going to say something.
Well, I have a comment about vocabulary. My 12th grade English teacher said, you rear children and you raise pigs. It's sort of old-fashioned, but it also gives a perspective on bringing up children.
Well, I think that vocabulary is so important, isn't it? I mean, the kind of language we have to articulate what we're doing is important. Yeah.
It's interesting. My husband is a youth director and spending a lot more time around high schoolers, and I'm not that far from high school myself, so the vocabulary has really changed in that amount of time, and I find myself, like, wanting to speak the language, like the lingo, and have all the terms and everything so I can be cool. But once I just decided that makes me really fake, I just started like talking just how I talk, and I mean, they're totally like, we're all, you know, close, and I just think that's so cool when you're just yourself and
Yes, and you're expanding their vocabulary,
right, exactly,
by keeping your own.
Exactly.
Will you say something here?
Yes, I was going to say something. I think this is a wonderful age in the fact that we have cell phones, and a program that I have, it allows me free time on weekends. And I live in Northwest Washington, and my grandson lives in east of Orlando, Florida. And I remember one time we had a 55-minute conversation, my 19-year-old grandson and I, and I've learned a lot about how he thinks and feels, and his ideas about all of life and politics and homosexuality and in his generation.
That's so the cell phone has been kind of helpful. I mean, since we got on this, what are some other occasions, you know, how do you create a space for more conversation? you were saying, you know, like playing the games or certainly dinner, you know, the phone. What are some other ways you found?
Television, believe it or not. When my son's nearly 26, when he comes home to visit, he likes to watch those shows like Friends and stuff.
Mm-hmm. No.
And I otherwise, yeah. I'm probably the only human being on the planet who has seen a complete show of Seinfeld.
Right, right.
And I would never, but, you know, talk about, you know, this person's a total idiot. Why would anybody listen to them?
Yes.
You know, how does this person live? You know, they're too dumb to be alive, or he'll say something, whatever, you know, mm-hmm. this sort of thing. Kind of that interchange about this. Yeah. Or sometimes he'll ask, well, didn't you ever room with people like this?
Mm-hmm.
No, I was spared that, or, you know, I just had the dope fiend who was a thief, and, you know, I was too dumb to know that until it was too late. You know, that
right.
creates a whole...
Well, that's a good point, too. And watching these shows with your children, I mean, they do watch, according to one study, it's 27 hours of television a week of children under 18. And that is without the computer, that's out video games, it's 27 hours. I mean, that's a lot of time. That's almost like a part-time job. I mean, and if you don't have 27 hours, how could that add up? How could it possibly be real? But, well, you have breakfast, watch a little show, you know, you come home, watch a couple of hours, it adds up. And so that's a very good point to at least be there some of the time to, I would cut it down, way down, but at least watch it together.
Mm-hmm. I have two children entering, one in teenage years and one about to enter, one of each, boy and girl. And I think one thing I've tried to do, and now that they're getting, I can finally say getting a little bit older, I try and take them out just by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because now they love to go to restaurants.
Oh, yeah.
We couldn't do it for the longest time. That's one of my favorite pastimes. And now it's becoming quite enjoyable, and that really gives a very nice opportunity. But I don't think there's any way really to predict it, because I think you have to be observant and just seize the moment when it's appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
Especially with teenagers and parties and driving, and you just...
Yeah.
It's kind of... you just have to pick the right time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's a good suggestion too, the restaurant thing. One friend of mine, every other week, the parent goes out, one of the parents goes to breakfast with the older child. They have a younger child. But that's kind of then a ritual, so you don't have to negotiate it all the time. And yeah, okay, it's our breakfast. But now they're a little younger and it's not so complex. But
no, maybe just a Jamba Juice or Starbucks.
Right.
Well, my kids eat too much. It costs too
much.
And they like good food. You know?
They don't want junk. Are you going to say something new? Uh-huh.
Well, this is kind of going what the church can do. And I know a lot of church confirmation programs, one of the expectations is to share highs and lows in the confirmation program
yeah.
in small groups, but then also to carry that home. And the expectation is to have that with your family, to share highs and lows at each
yeah.
day. And in some ways, it's contrived, and it doesn't always work at the junior high age, because they haven't established that ritual until then. And all of a sudden say, now we're going to start doing this. And there's some resistance. And even with our kids, we did it for a little while, but it just kind of seemed a little bit too artificial. But it's still in place, and there's still opportunity. Every so often we'll just kind of ask, well, what was your high and low today?
Mm-hmm.
And then we will share that too as parents. And so mm-hmm. it's another opportunity for kids just to think about their day, what was the high point, what was the
mm-hmm.
low point. And also hear the parents share what, you know, was their high and low for that
yeah, it's
day.
A good tradition, too.
You know, it is.
And it's nice, you know, when you have the language somewhere else. When it's not just you saying the high and low, but the church is saying the high
yeah.
and low. So it's kind of like, oh yeah, I guess everybody's talking about the high and low, you know?
Right.
So it sounds normal.
Right, yeah. Right.
But that's right. good. You were going to say something about
I guess in our lives, we both of us work long hours, so we actually, I guess I put parenting second after careers, and that's probably not a good thing. But our kids are 8, 10, and 13 years old. And I find that
you know, when I put them, I tuck them each into bed and I say prayers with each of them individually, and they each still have a song that I sing to them. And that is a song about them from when they were very small. And that's our tradition, and they will invariably have something that they need to tell me.
Yeah.
And that's their time alone, just with me. And that is a great time to talk. And and what I also find is that if I have kids that are still restless and going to the bathroom three or four times and having three or four drinks, that means that they are still getting up the courage to tell mom whatever god-awful thing happened today.
Yeah.
Because, and they've just gotten into a habit that whatever it is, good or bad, that's their opportunity to tell to tell me. And that is really nice. And it's interesting that even in a family where parents work such long days, that the children have found the time to communicate with the parents. And I think the kids find that. They will find it if you don't.
But it's neat you had that ritual sort of around. It's like, you know, here's the story, here's this. And then it opens it up. So it's not, again, negotiating it every time, like, are we going to talk, are we not going to talk? Our son, too, when it's dark and you turn the lights off and you're supposed to say, then it all comes out. It's so interesting.
And it's one-on-one. It's a safe environment. It's not like the other two kids are listening or anything. And it could take 5 minutes or it could take an hour, especially with our oldest. He could talk for a whole hour at night about, you know, whatever happened that he needs to say.
Okay. I think we have time. Yeah, one more.
Well, I'm just going to kind of tie all this together, and this word ritual keeps coming up. And I, as a parent, I find that is so helpful to have these rituals, this bedtime ritual, going out to breakfast, to establish someplace that's regular and that the kids can depend on, and they know, well, if I do need to talk, that is available to me. That's so important.
That is good, and it is a boy. You can tie so many things in that way, and they can be just little funny, silly rituals. They can be deep rituals tied with the church or the church year. They can be all kinds of things. There's a couple books. I think I have them on that one more general bibliography by Doherty, a guy in Minneapolis who does so much with families, and then this Pfeiffer. They both mentioned a lot about the ritual because it doesn't take the energy. It's just there, and then you do it, and then it opens up space. You don't have to spend so much energy creating what you're going to do. So that's a nice note to end on. Well, thank you so much for your participation and everything. Yeah, thank you.